Akhbarism, we can call them.
Yes, yes, yes.
Akhbarism. Akhbarism is to focus on traditions and hadith without thinking about that, whether this is a real hadith or not. They don't seek and check the roots of hadith, whether it was said by Imam or not. All sentences, all words which were written in the books called hadith, they accept them, all of them, as hadith, without searching the roots. So, you know, after the problem of caliphate in the time of Imam Ali, some of them, they believe that because of this problem, we should defend Imam, we should defend Ahlul Bayt. But the way was wrong. Defending Ahlul Bayt by all words that are called hadith made a lot of problems. So they didn't know that what kind of problem this viewpoint can make.
That's right.
Sayyid Ali Tabatabai, I can call him the symbol of moderation at that time. He fought the extremism in the side of Sunni and extremism in the side of Shia, both of them as well.
That's right.
So the extremists in Sunni part, they attacked and they started a war, so he made a wall.
Yes.
But what about this extremist? They attacked by their books, by their idea.
Yes.
They made a scientific wall around the beliefs of Shia by that book. So that's why I can call him the symbol of moderation at that time, real moderation.
That's all right. Okay, as you said, his achievements were really great on that time. And this was the line that was established by Wahid al-Bahbahani in the city of Karbala, you know. And this was how the Hawza al-Almiya of the Karbala was changed in the method and the approach to the Islamic sciences. That's all right. Okay, anything missed, Sheikh Rouhani?
Just some of the, let's say, moral or ethical, let's say, characteristics of these Allama is also interesting.
Very good.
As it is mentioned by some of the great Shiite scholars like Abu Ali Ha'iri, the author of Rawadat, or the Sheikh Abbas Qummi, the author of Rehanat al-Adab.
Yes.
In these great books, they mentioned the name of these alim, these great scholars, with the titles like Thiqa, trusty, we can say, trustworthy, we can say, and Jalilul Qadr, which means very great, very outstanding scholar, muhaqqiq, and unique kind of scholar in the history. Yeah, these are some of the titles that were given to him by some of the great scholars. And he was very much careful and cautious about haqqun nas. He was always trying to preserve these things.
We know that at his time, so many of the wujuhat, the monies, you know, the blocks of monies were coming from Indian, especially subcontinent, because the Shias were living over there, so they paid the khums zakat over there. So, say, like a mountain, okay? Yeah. The gold and the monies were over there, but all the monies were spent for the Shias around the city of Karbala. It says some gardens or some grounds were bought in order to be the source of the kinship, how can I say, the charity and the blessings for the Shias living over there. That's all right. About his demise, it is mentioned that it was 1231, according to the lunar Hijri calendar. He passed away in the city of Karbala. His body was taken into the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and he was buried beside or close to the tomb of Wahid al-Bahbahani, his professor and his teacher. May Allah bless the soul of Sayyid Ali Tabatabai, the author of Riyaz al-Masail. He is mainly known as Sahib Riyaz in the Islamic seminaries. Thank you, my Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding his life. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Lost in history. Memories are sweet and heartwarming, but they also bring along the regrets of loss. People usually visit relics to alleviate this feeling They visit the old neighborhoods, people, and houses that are full of memories. But reviewing the past torments my family, my compatriots, and me, not only can we not go back in time, but we can't go back to where our past was formed. All that is left for us are movies that open our old wounds. Our house was lost in history and right in front of people's eyes. I am Edward Said. I was born in 1935 into a Christian family in this house. My father was a successful merchant who imported stationery from Egypt.
Not only the eldest, but he was also the only boy in the family. So I think we thought of him, his sisters, a bit as he was getting a good deal, as they say.
I was 10 or 11 years old when I little by little realized the presence of Jewish immigrants in the city. Our city was experiencing a chaotic situation in those days. Our house was not far from King David Hotel, so I was terrified when that King David Hotel bombing happened.
Jewish terrorists bombed the King David Hotel in 1946. The wreckage could be seen from our house. I recall the rising sense of danger, British soldiers on the alert, and news of impending war between Palestinians and Jewish forces.
A year later, we went to Cairo with all our relatives and family members because the situation became too difficult. That was a one-way trip with no return date.
Most of my family left Jerusalem because they had to. Our house was in an area that was totally unprotected, and it was in an area that fell to the Haganah in, I think, February of 1948. There was, to my recollection, there was no militia. There was no organized resistance of any sort. By the time the fighting began in the latter part of 1947, it became impossible to live there. And there was a general sense of panic. And my family left at the end of December of 47.
In Cairo, my father sent me to an English language school, and I found my interests in literature. My father was a wealthy man with aristocratic morals. He was proud of his U.S. passport and asked everyone to call him William. He was very organized and cared so much about discipline.
In relation to me, he was very severe. I had four sisters. He was much more partial to my sisters. And for him, I was constantly to be reformed. And in many ways, he focused on certain parts of my body. For example, my back. He was very upset at the fact that I didn't have a military posture. So there was a lot of my childhood was devoted to training my back. Training it, he would say. And so on and so forth. So there was a lot of that. There was always my mother, who, of course, counterbalanced it. You know, and she tried to spoil me.
My mother was a gentle and kind woman. She took me to the best music teachers' classes of that time, and she motivated me to learn about music.
All of the things that matter to me today, music, literature, ideas really, I owe to my mother.
I was old enough to go to university, and I studied medicine for a few years, but I did not like my field of study. For this reason, I was expelled from Victoria College in Cairo in 1962. My father was disappointed with me and sent me to the United States to study. It was the same decision that my grandfather took for my father in Bulgarian-Ottoman Wars period to keep his son out of it.
My father sent him because in those days, American law, we were American citizens. American law was such that if he didn't go by a certain age, he would lose his citizenship. So my father wanted to make sure that he kept his citizenship.
I happened to be a student at the American University at the time, from 60 onward, where Edward's sister was a classmate of mine. So I got to know the family, I got to know her, and then
In the U.S., I chose what I was interested in and studied English literature. I was really interested in literature and made a lot of effort. Finally, I got my Ph.D. from Harvard University. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Joseph Conrad.
About 20 or 21, I'd read literally everything he'd ever written. And then, of course, I knew that he wasn't English and he was an outsider. And I didn't make any association with myself, although obviously he was answering to some very deep affinity that I felt with him.
Like me, Joseph Conrad was originally from another country and was born in Poland. He traveled to many countries and finally came to the U.S. and wrote his famous novels in English, just like me. I had a good life in the U.S. and everything seems to be in order until the event of 1967 that came as a great shock to me and completely changed the course of my life. Israel attacked the Egyptian army in the Sinai Peninsula. So six Arab states went to war with Israel. The war lasted only 6 days and resulted in the tripling of Israeli territories.
And that was important for understanding this shift in attitudes towards Israel and Zionism, because as the U.S. faced defeat in Southeast Asia, the victory that Israel represented in defeating the Arab states in 1967 was this seen as this incredibly positive sign of the West recovering its sense of purpose and its military prowess and so on.
And I first met him, he was just an American professor, but his connection with the Palestinian movement was after 67.
And then when the war broke out in 1967, I was desolated. I was in New York at the time, and I was completely shattered. The world as I understood it and knew it had completely ended at that moment. And it was shortly thereafter that I began for the first time, and I'd been in America already for 15 or 16 years, and I began for the first time to be in touch with other Arabs.
I think between 67 and the 1973 war, when Israel expanded again, he became increasingly concerned with the question of Palestine and the situation of Palestinians and of the Arab world in general.
By 1970, I was completely involved. I had started to write in this country, and I was immediately politically involved up to my neck.
Edward also, at that time, began to realize that he is damn Palestinian. And it's okay to stand up for the downtrodden, to actually regain that identity. It was in that environment that I think.
Because I discovered then that I had to rethink my my life and my identity, even though it had been so sort of sheltered and built up in this completely artificial way. I had to rethink it from the start.
We did exactly what you expect us to do. We were just modern, we talk your language, we studied your language, and then all of a sudden this society here slapped them. They said, no, you are dirty Arabs because you couldn't even war, you couldn't even fight. The whole war lasted only 6 days. That kind of immediate collapse of the Arab armies at that time had a very, very deep influence on those, and they felt insulted.
Now, after a few years of a seemingly successful life in the United States and teaching at one of America's best universities, I felt like nothing more than a fugitive. Nothing was the same as before.
He said that directly, I'll never be home. When someone like Edward Said says, I'll never be home, that's something strange. But if you think like a Palestinian, you'll understand.
The idea of being a fugitive is just like being affected by leprosy. You feel alone in the middle of the crowd. A fugitive can never be expelled from his homeland and can never return to it. A fugitive feels like a parasite. A fugitive is an uninvited guest who has got nothing in common with his place of residence and is always considered a stranger. All Palestinians feel the same sense of exile. Yasser Arafat before the United Nations General Assembly on November 13, 1974.
I met him for a long period of time when he came to the United Nations here in November of 1974. And he had the speech that was cobbled together, and I was asked by him to put it into English, which he gave at the General Assembly. And then from then on, I started to see him regularly.
After this famous speech, the Palestine Liberation Organization was granted observer status at the UN, and the Palestinians were given the right to determine the fate of their inhabited territories. However, this situation did not last long. I became a member of Palestinian National Council for the first time 3 years before this speech, Palestinian Immigrants and Deportees Parliament. I felt like I had found my homeland again, and I had to fight to reach it.
What do you think of when you think of an Arab? Somebody with a towel on their head, camel, and maybe some sand. Want to throw a pyramid in there? Well, guess who's here? Right on our stage. This itself would not have been possible not long ago. Edward Said joins us, professor of English, Columbia University, member of the Palestine National Council, to which umbrella organization belongs, the PLO.
I spoke loudly about the reality of the Palestinian problems, and I even had to speak in front of pro-Israel Jews.
I think the main point is, if you want to negotiate some kind of peace with justice, you cannot legislate in advance who's going to represent whom. The Israeli position and the position of the ADL is that we are not only entitled to decide what to talk about, but we're going to decide who to talk to. Now, the Palestinians have their own representatives, and nobody has found any other representatives for the Palestinians except the PLO. After all, it was the Israeli government, A, that dispossessed the Palestinians, that destroyed Lebanon in 1982, killed...
The Israeli government...
Try as he or she might, a Palestinian finds it very difficult. I won't say impossible, but I think it's very, very hard. And I think most Palestinians are like most people. It's very hard for the Palestinian who feels himself or herself to have been the victim of injustice by Jews, Israeli Jews, to sympathize or imaginatively incorporate the history of the Holocaust and say, well, we forgive them for what they did. I mean, after all, they suffered this colossal historical tragedy, the Jews did. And the fact that they are evicting us from our territory, that they are placing us under occupation, that they're treating us as third-class citizens, that they are killing our people, that they are confining us to camps, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we understand. Nobody can understand that. I mean, you can grasp the first fact, the fact of the Holocaust, but you can't translate that into your own doom.
My mind has always been busy with this question. What is the reason behind the occupation of Palestine and the Western support for the occupier? In my opinion, this issue is rooted in the way the West looks at the East, and the Palestinian cause emerges in this point of view.
This war between peoples, a war which has been fought for generations, and which concerns the whole world, is, I believe, inextricably entangled with the fantasies, dreams, and ambitions of the West to rule and possess the East.
There's also a question of how Zionism conceives Arabs, and it has become current for Arabs to call Zionism a racist ideology. Now, what, Patrick Seal, is the basis of that charge?
Well, I know it's a charge which created outrage when it was first raised. I think at the UN they tried to dub Zionism as a racist thing. But you see, unfortunately, I think there is something in it. I mean, much as one hates to say so, but if you just look at some of the statements, say, of a man like Begin, I mean, he's always ranting about Jewish blood and how precious it is, with the implication, of course, that Arab blood is much less precious. And he says things like, Palestinians are animals walking on two paws. Or you remember his chief of staff at the time, Raful Eitan, talked about Palestinians being cockroaches in a bottle.
It is the default option of Europeans that the perfect and normal man is the same European man who has existed since ancient Greece. In the subconscious of a Western white man, an Eastern man is not considered an equal to a Western man in terms of humanity.
He talks about blood libel against the Jews, or of course his famous phrase at the time of the Sabra and Shatila massacre. He said, if Goyim kill Goyim, what concern is it of ours? Now that, it seems to me, is an absolutely racial remark.
In another way, I'd like to reformulate and say that had there been in the United States, for example, immigration laws which said that only white Anglo-Saxon Protestants can emigrate and get a citizenship, then you as a Jew and I as a Palestinian would object. Now, the same law, in an inverse formulation of the same law, which says that only a Jew can emigrate to Israel, whereas a Palestinian who is born there and can...
So for him, the writing of Orientalism was actually shaped by his engagement with the question of Palestine.
My years of research in literary and historical texts led me to the theory that I presented in Orientalism.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And in this very brief series of three lectures on these last days and nights of the month of Ramadan, the plan was to go over supplication number 45 of Imam Zainul Abidin wa Sayyid al-Sajideen alayhi salatu wassalam, the supplication which he read to God, which he made actually, not read, but he made this prayer and plea and petition to God at the end of the month of Ramadan to say farewell to it. The next part of the dua, the Imam says something very beautiful. He's a man of beauty as it is, right? So every word he utters is a word of beauty. But he says, so we bid farewell to it, meaning that we bid farewell to Ramadan, this wida that we're doing. You know, we have the Jummatul Wida. He says we bid farewell to Ramadan as well, with the farewell of one whose parting pains us. We have we have the Azadari in Muharram. Imam is saying we have Azah over the parting of the month of Ramadan from us. Just as we cry over the parting of Imam Hussein alayhi salam from us, we cry over the parting of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam when we mark his martyrdom or his death in the month of Safar. When we cry and lament over the separation between us and Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam, Imam Sajjad says, you know what, I have a state of azah, a grief of Ramadan, the month of Ramadan leaving me. And he says, we bid farewell to this month who's leaving us, fills us with gloom and loneliness, the gham and the wahsha. The Imam uses these words, the ghammana wa, he says, you know, I have that sadness over the gham and the wahsha that we'll feel, the loneliness, the sadness. He's really showing us, brothers and sisters, and I said this, you know, last night, that he's at a different level because of the way he sees the month of Ramadan. It's not, as I see it, as a chore, a taxing burden on me to eat at strange times, to sleep at awkward times, to engage in acts which are not normally done. The Imam is looking at Ramadan in a different light. But look at how he says goodbye to the month. You know, and there are so many ways that we, you know, when we look at it at a personal level, if you had a close friend or a beloved family member and they were going to leave you to go to another city, maybe they're leaving Vancouver to travel to another part of the British Columbia, or they're leaving BC to go to another province, or they're leaving BC to move to another country, how would you say goodbye to that person? How would you part with them? How would you bid them farewell? You might walk to their car. You may drive them to the airport. You'll go to the last part before they go into the security area of the airport, and you'll be right there to see them off. But sometimes you may have a person that, okay, you know them well. They're a friend in the mosque or from work or colleague, and they're leaving the business or they're leaving the company. They're moving. And you'll have a farewell party for them at work, and you'll buy them a gift, and then that's it. You won't go to the airport. Or maybe you may even have people who you don't even really care about. I mean, they're a part of the society, but you're not attached to them, that you really worry about them, where they're moving. So they move, okay, big deal. You know, another person gone. Or you go to the grocery store and you're dealing with a cashier, and you pay your money and you leave with your bags and your groceries. Yeah, you're saying goodbye, but you have no emotional attachment to that person. They're just there doing a service to you. So my point in giving you these examples is, what is our relationship with Ramadan? Is it like our relationship with the cashier at the Walmart or the department store? We're just there for a few minutes, do our transaction and leave. Was that our relationship with Ramadan? Or was it, no, like our... like a close family member or friend who's moving to another part of the world, and we're going to, you know, drive them to the airport. We're going to carry their bags for them. We're going to help them check in. We're going to see them right off to the last stop in the airport before we can't go any further. How are we dealing with the month of Ramadan as it came, as we were in it, and as it now leaves us after 29 or 30 days is the question that I pose to you. And I pose to myself, first and foremost, hand on heart. How am I going to say goodbye to Ramadan? Good riddance. You're gone. You're done with. Tired of you. 30 days. You stressed me out. What a waste of my time. What a waste of my life. I could have been sleeping. Could have been enjoying food and the normal times of the day. Or do we actually feel the parting of Ramadan from us? Like a close friend leaving. We're like a family member going on a trip that we may not see them again. You know, the Imam then goes on to say that this month is a month in which we owed it it had a claim above us. It had an inviolability. It had a hurma to it. There's a sanctity to Ramadan that we had to observe. And it had a haq, a right that we had to give the month. You know, just as people around us have rights, you know, in Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, in his beautiful work, the Risalat al-Huquq, he talks about the rights of our family, the rights of our religious scholars, the rights of our body parts, etc. He says that the month of Ramadan had a right over us, how we treated it, how we respected it. It's not a human being, right? The month of Ramadan is not a human being. But the Imam is showing us a very unique aspect of the Islam, that it's almost as if it has taken on a life form, how you bid it farewell. Did you respect it? Did you honor it? Did you cherish it? Did you fulfill the rights that the month has over you? And I'm coming to the end for tonight. I'm going to finish in about the next 7 to 8 minutes. But then the Imam begins a very beautiful farewell bid to the month of Ramadan. And again, I'm leaving a lot out, brothers and sisters, so please, I apologize, but again, you can look at this on your own and read and reflect on the lines. I just want to highlight certain passages that really resonate with me that I hope will resonate with you as well. So the Imam then says, فَنَحْنُ قَائِلُونَ. So we are those people who say to you, O the month of Ramadan, أَسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكَ يَا شَهْرَ اللَّهِ الْأَكْبَرِ وَيَا إِيدَ أَوْلِيَائِهِ. Peace be upon you, O greatest month of Allah and the festival, the Eid of His friends. Now he's saying goodbye to Ramadan, but he's calling it the Eid of the Awliya. We haven't gotten to Eid yet, you know, it's still early. But he's calling Ramadan the day of he's calling the Ramadan the period of Eid of the friends of Allah. Now there's a lot to unpack in here. I'm going to try to see how much I can do in the next 5 or 6 minutes, you know. But one of the things the Imam is showing us here is that we greet the month by saying Assalamu alayka ya shahr Allah al-Akbar, for example. But don't you and I normally greet people? You might have fish at home. I don't know if you're like me, who talks to his guppies in his tank. But do you go up to your fish tank and say Assalamu alayka ya goldfish? Assalamu alayka ya, you know, whatever fish you have. Do you say salam to your hamster at home, or your kittens, or your budgies, or your parakeets? Most people don't talk to their animals, although Rasulullah would often do that. And, you know, there are stories about the Prophet and his interaction with animals, but we don't normally talk to animals. And we surely don't say salam to an animal or a wall or a tree when we go in the hiking in the forest. We say, you know, assalamu alayka, yeah, beautiful redwood tree in Stanley Park, and give it a hug. We tend not to do that. But here the Imam is showing us, he says, Assalamu alayka ya shahr Allah al-Akbar. Greetings be upon you, O the greatest month of God. So we greet the month of Allah, Shahrullah, Shahru Ramadan. We greet the month of Ramadan, the month of Allah, the month of the Ummah, with Assalamu alayka. Peace be upon you.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matim شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear ladies. This is your program, A Muslim Lady. I am Asma. I have the pleasure to be your host. And in here we have Sister Zainab with us. Welcome, sister.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much for having me.
Wa alaikum assalam. It's always a pleasure to have you here. And I'm sure we're going to have so much of interesting stuff to talk about. Well, previously on Muslim Lady, we've been talking about the fact that marriage is not going to put a full stop in a woman's lifestyle, in her career, in the things that she's going to flourish, and in the process of the things she is going to improve in her life, in her personality, or whatever, from every aspect. Now we got that. We came to an agreement that, okay, it's not a full stop. But then what about those women whom they think after their marriage, they need some encouragements to follow, to pursue the things they've been doing before their marriage as to improve themselves and to flourish in different aspects of their life?
First of all, marriage is not a full stop. What society is trying to teach us, what friends try to teach us, what other cultures, you know, many cultures say that if you marry, you're over.
Yeah.
Your career is over and all. But no, how if you intend to be a housewife now, if you're a housewife, but you also have a higher education.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, how can you serve? Today, you have many, many options. Today, you have many, many choices there. Like in Lady Fatima Zahra's life, as we have been giving examples from her life, she was definitely not working outside her home. She was inside her home, but her education level was definitely much more higher than that of what we have today. And what women would do, they would come to her house and they would ask her, like it's reported once one of the women comes to her house and she asks regarding her mother, who is old. She wants to ask some of the questions regarding her salat, like how she can offer, what she should be doing and all. So her questions go on and she answers some 10 questions. And after Lady Fatima Zahra answers 10 questions, the lady feels shy to ask more because she feels like I made her tired. And then Lady Fatima Zahra, she smiles and asks her, whatever you want to ask, ask again. Okay?
Yeah.
You can ask me any question anymore.
Do not hesitate.
Yeah, do not hesitate. She gives her example just for a change of mood so that she can ask very clearly without any shyness, without any hesitance. She says that if you give 1,000 dinars to someone and tell him, like, you know, to take this brick to the top floor, will he get tired? She says no. So she says, in the same way, I don't get tired when you ask me questions because I know the rewards of the service that I'm doing to you. If I'm answering you one question, I'm getting rewards from between the skies, the heavens, and the earth. I'm getting much more rewards that I should be getting just to serve you in terms of knowledge.
Yeah, just to help you with your questions.
Yeah, so, you know, doing educational services, that time was very tough.
Yeah.
And
there were no means, actually.
Yeah, and she would not get tired even because that those days everything was supposed to be done by your hands. Everything was supposed to be done with your, you know...
with much of difficulty and drudgery.
You had no facilities to carry out things soon. So, like, she would have said to herself, all right, who would answer her? I have to, you know... be taking now, I have to be making flour, I have to be making this, I have to be getting
cook
water.
For my children.
And that too, in those difficult days, in those difficult times when they had no facilities. Today, you put on rice in the rice cooker and you can do 10 other things at the same time.
And not just that, everything has been prepared for you.
Yeah, so when she's teaching us that I can serve people with more than questions that they have and answering them like this, without showing that lack of energy or lack of interest, why can't we today? If I'm staying at home, I can at
least... Although we have too much of facilities and equipment.
Yes, today, like we have, you can record things.
Mm-hmm.
Those days, we didn't have things like that. You can record things, you can make sermons.
You can go to online classes without leaving your house even.
Exactly. You can learn more.
Yeah.
You can continue education. You can actually flourish more.
Mm-hmm.
So just see like happening, what is happening in this country, the Islamic Republic. That was very strange for me. And that was, again, very, very interesting for me was that people often, they continue their education after marriage.
Yeah.
That
and
was...
I would tell you a story after we go for a break. Welcome back, Muslim ladies. You are listening to your program and we're talking about the improvement of a woman after her marriage. Well, we understood previously that, okay, marriage is not a full stop to her life, but right now she needs encouragement. And those encouragements come from her partner, comes from her perspectives, her viewpoints of life and whatever. And then we were talking about the facilities. In past, women did not have too much of facilities to help them inside the house and study at the same time. But right now, you can see there are many online courses for women to study, to start even education after a very old age. And I told you that I have an example. A perfect example of this is one of our friends. The girl married at the age of, I guess, 16 or 17. So when she married, the same story that happened to you happened to her. Everybody told her, okay, now you killed yourself. This was an end to your life. And then you can do nothing more.
Yeah.
But then what happened is that she, after many years, I don't say very quickly, when she was 25, she started her education again, though her children were, you know, in a time where they needed much of care and much of whatever, you know, as children.
Okay.
But still, she managed to do all of them at the same time, taking care of her husband, bringing about her children, and still finishing her education and going to university. So this was like a big, big inspiration for everyone.
Every woman here who is studying in the Hausa, especially because I have seen these women in Hausa mostly, they all deserve
salutes. Which is
salutes.
Their religious seminary.
Yeah, they all deserve salutes because I have been seeing them. I won't say I saw any duffer.
Mm-hmm.
They were all intelligent. They were all writing notes in the class.
Yeah.
They were all handling kids. They were all doing tens of thousands of things at the same time. And I was like, oh my God, this is not a full stop at all.
Yeah.
Definitely they have chosen the husbands who help them, who allow them to carry on their education mm-hmm. like this. And but however, what we are learning from Lady Zahra Sallallahu Alaiha's life is that she was also in the home, but she was serving. She was serving her society through education.
Yeah.
So
enlightening the other women.
Yeah. You, if you're not able to do a job right now, if you're not able to go out for higher education right now, you have online options today. You have online courses today.
And too much of books. And you have internet, you know.
Yeah,
in past, people had to go for books. And those to reach those books, you had to go pay too much of money, maybe travel to other countries. But right now, everything is available. You don't even have to buy the book. There are PDFs.
It's so, so accessible. Everything has become so, so, like, I won't say just PDFs. You have audiobooks.
Yeah, audiobooks.
What I often do is, like, I make my child sleep and I keep listening to an audiobook at the same time. And that's how my child goes to sleep rather than listening to some you know, nursery rhymes or something.
So you do your job while doing their job.
Yeah, I'm also pampering my child. And at the same time, I am listening to audiobook. So you could do multiple tasks at mm-hmm. home. And you can actually increase your knowledge. And also you can teach others, again, through online courses, mm-hmm. again through whatever the internet has given you service today, through different social media platforms. Or, you know, many people like today, they make pages, they start exploring themselves.
Yeah, no, this is the funniest part. Let's go for a break and then we'll be back talking about this very interesting part as well.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
You are listening to Muslim Lady, and we're talking about these all wonder women that we have around ourselves. They are women. They have married. They have children, and still they manage to do plenty much of things. And you were talking about social media, and there is also another aspect to women's life nowadays. They start doing some beneficial things for the other people in their society while they're at home. Yet they're just using their cell phones and making these pages in which they can, you know, entertain people. And at the same time, they teach them things, which is very nice.
Yes. Imam Ali Sam says, the one who taught me even a single word, I'm servant to that person. So you can actually serve people yourself, or you can learn a lot from following
proper pages.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, being a woman does not mean I have to follow body image pages all the time.
Yeah.
Maybe I will get depressed following those pages. Mm-hmm. Being a woman means to explore your knowledge.
To enlighten yourself.
Exactly. See the different forms of how I can add to my leisure time.
Yeah.
How I can make different foods like in less time.
Exactly.
How I can save my time. How I can pamper my kids in a better way. You know, doing a lot of stuff, you can actually add to your knowledge, and also you can serve others again through the same platforms. You know, you can share your experiences.
Exactly.
Because what is the fun of the experience or your education that you learned, that you spent so much of money and you earned it, and now you're just staying home? I'm not saying that don't stay home, but try to serve, at least write a book.
Yeah, and then, you know, there were some pages that I was just seeing in Instagram, and they were just like an inspiration. Really, they work too well. Oh, there was this woman who was sharing all her diary in a very beautiful way in there. And then many people told her that after being with you, after being introduced to you, we feel like our lives have been changed, have gone through too much of changes. One of the women out there told her that I was going through a depression, but just reading your things, your stuff, and listening to your suggestions for about how to improve my own self, my personality in dealing with problems, then I figured out that, okay, life is not as difficult as I am making it for myself.
Yeah.
So this woman is doing too much.
Exactly. That's a service.
Yeah.
That's a service. If you take out someone out of depression, it has its own rewards.
So many women are doing that right now.
There's so many narrations. Like, if you make your believer, if you make one of the believers happy, Allah makes you happy in that world. So we have so many things that how important it is, how valuable it is to take someone out of depression. So you can not only just take someone out of depression, you can actually, if you're not able to, if you're not extrovert, like making pages and you're not into it,
because
women especially, most of them, they are not extroverts, you know, they're introverts. All right, still you want to use your knowledge. You can write an article. Start writing an article.
Exactly, yeah.
You know?
Articles that might change the lives of men.
If writing books seems to be difficult for you, write an article. If even writing articles seems to be difficult for you, write your own quotes.
Exactly.
Write your own experiences.
Just try to write down whatever that comes to your mind.
Yeah.
That might be useful for many people. So, I guess, after all what we said, we come to this conclusion that today there's no justification for a woman to say, okay, I cannot do anything because I'm married, because I have children, because of this, because of that. All these things are just false excuses. If a woman wants to flourish her talent, she can do it. Whether it be a single woman or a married woman, it depends on your priorities. It depends on your motivation, on how much you want to flourish yourself.
Again, I would say that men should take this as a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If any of the women in the house is flourishing in terms of knowledge or in terms of, you know, culturally doing wonders, they should be like that of Imam Ali alayhi salam, go for sujood, go for prostration and thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for this blessing.
Yeah, for that blessing. Yeah, that was the gist of what we were talking about. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Hidden Files.
being punished for the original sin, and that is beating white supremacy colonialism. That is how some experts describe what has happened and continues to happen to a small but significant nation in the Caribbean, Haiti. Slavery in Haiti began after the arrival of Christopher Columbus on the island in 1492 with European colonists that followed from Portugal, Spain, and France. In the late 18th century and early 19th century, in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was once called, the French had enslaved 500,000 Africans there. Well, the slaves would harvest coffee, sugarcane, and work the cotton fields and serve the Europeans in whatever ways the colonialists deemed necessary. This island became France's most lucrative possession. Ultimately, the slaves who were treated terribly started revolting against the French. Now, this movement ultimately led to their victory over the imperialist colonialists, and Haiti became the only country in the world where former slaves succeeded in overthrowing their enslavers and establishing their own country. These Africans were able to beat one of the best militaries at the time that was led by Napoleon. He sent 50,000 French troops to the island, but ultimately France and their European and American supporters lost. This is the original sin that Africans were successful in beating European colonizers, and some analysts say the American-European front has never forgiven Haiti for winning and for being black. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Haiti set an example when it declared its independence in 1804. It became the first country in the world to permanently outlaw slavery and ban imperial rule. During a time when slavery was the norm in many countries, Haiti was the symbol of freedom. Haiti broke the common rule of the day that liberty and equality were for white men only. Haiti said that no human beings should ever be enslaved. It sounds very enlightening, but that is not how the French, the Americans, and others saw it. Leaders wanted to do whatever they could in order for Haiti not to succeed. And those who revolted in Haiti wanted to do whatever they could in order for the revolution to succeed.
U.S. President Thomas Jefferson was worried that the revolution in Haiti could ignite a slave revolt in the United States. And he would do his best not to help Haiti's southern slaveholders, who were very fearful that this could spread and encourage U.S. politicians to overthrow the new country. Napoleon Bonaparte, French military leader at the time, wrote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever the forward march of blacks in the world." After Haiti had routed the French and its allies, the first leader of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, said about the victory, "These impeccable enemies of the rights of man have been punished for their crimes. Yes, we have paid these true cannibals back, crime for crime, war for war, outrage for outrage. I have saved my country. I have avenged America."
Well, when listening to the story of Haiti, it sounds like a part of history that took place a long time ago in the past. But the reality is that as we bring you this program today, the Haitian people are on the streets and have been for months. The people are demanding an end to foreign intervention and the theft of their wealth. They want the United Nations not to interfere, and they want these Western and so-called international entities to stop impoverishing Haiti and to stop trying to enslave this nation once again. Well, to help me look at this further, I'd like to turn to our guest, Dr. Jemima Pierre.
Dr. Jemima Pierre is a professor of African American Studies and Anthropology. Currently, she teaches at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. She is the coordinator of the Haiti Americas team, Black Alliance for Peace, and editor and contributor for the Black Agenda Report.
Well, Dr. Pierre, thanks so much for being with us here at Hidden Files. You know, whenever we hear anything about Haiti, it is always negative and the country's demonized. In your perspective, why is that the case?
Well, you know, there's a great quote by the African-American abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, who says that Haiti has never been forgiven for winning the revolution against slavery and colonialism. And so we have to start there. We have to start thinking about this 200 and some years of constant demonization, constant constant move to suppress Haitian self-determination. And so from the very beginning, so people should know that, for example, you know, Haiti became independent in 1804. The U.S. and the West did not really recognize Haitian independence until 1865. It's been hard going ever since then, trying to maintain sovereignty and independence. And the West, I think, really has a has this really deep, deep, deep hatred for that history because it did upend the entire system of slavery and colonization in the New World.
Well, I mean, what would you say to some people that, you know, that happened over 200 years ago? Why would they still try to punish Haiti today?
Well, it is interesting, right, to say that for such a country that, for a country that is so small, and for a country that seems insignificant, the U.S. really spends a lot of time and money trying to control it. And so we have to think about, for example, the fact that even after independence, what you had was constant affronts by the French, by the British, but by the U.S. So the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, which is the longest, one of the longest occupations in the region, very brutal. In fact, the U.S. Practiced its first aerial bombing campaigns in Haiti during that occupation. The U.S. has the fourth largest embassy in Haiti. So you're saying, well, if Haiti's so inconsequential, why does it have the fourth largest embassy? Why in 2003 did France, U.S., and Canada meet in Ottawa? Your listeners can look up the Ottawa Initiative. Met in Ottawa, basically coming up with a plan to remove the democratically elected president of Haiti, which plan succeeded in February 2004. The year of the 200th anniversary of the Haitian independence. And so there's a lot of history that demonstrates that there's this really deep, deep set of feelings among the Europeans for Haiti. And the way that Haiti is demonized and talked about in the news, the way that things are sensationalized. And so, you know, we in the U.S., where I am currently living, we have mass shootings every day. You know, the schools are in lockdown. This is a very violent country, but it doesn't get represented in the same way that Haiti does if we have a set of protesters. So there's a built-up history of representations of Haiti that allow the world to actually believe that these black people are savages that cannot run themselves. And, you know, the one quote that I wanted to show is, you know, Napoleon, whose army, which at the time was the most powerful army in the day, was defeated by the Haitians. And he wrote, and I have this quote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue," which is what Haiti was called, "is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever forward the march of the blacks of the world, in the world." And so if you start with that quote, what does that tell you about the feelings towards Haiti? And I think if you see that and then you see all the WikiLeaks files which were released and you see the machinations behind U.S. policy in Haiti, then everything comes clear to us. In the Security Council meetings, everyone was saying we need an intervention because there's gang violence. And so then you had the representatives from Albania, of all places, which is like at the edge of Europe and going through its own problems. It's going to have its own security, energy crisis in a couple of months. And then you have Ireland, which barely independent, and you have Kenya. And all these people are calling for intervention because they're saying we need to deal with gang violence. What's interesting is that what doesn't come up, especially for the Latin American countries, is that Haiti is under occupation, right? And that's what I want the world to know. In 2004, when the U.S. led coup d'etat that removed the president, put him on a plane, the U.S. Marines landed in his house, put him on a plane and flew him to Africa into exile, of all places. And then the U.S. sent the military. U.S., Canada, and France had military folks already on the ground within hours of this removal. And then they were able to get the UN to cover up this by sending in a Chapter 7 deployment of UN peacekeeping. And what you have then is you have this brutal force that was there, you know, with hundreds of thousands of soldiers, a whole apparatus. And then, but what was, what the reason, the way that they were able to hide this occupation, because they were able to get a multi-